Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Ulysses Bella of Ozo Motley on Occupy LA. Jackie DeSalvo updates us on what has been won thus far by the Occupy movement. For our weekly Earth segment, we speak with Ellen Choi, a young Chinese-Korean environmental activist, about environmental justice and the Occupy movement. A report from journalist Tina Gerhardt on the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting, APEC, now underway in Honolulu, Hawaii. And part three of our conversation with Erica Huggins, one of the few women leaders of the Black Panther Party. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. On a global day of student protest, a crowd estimated at 200 marched from the UCLA campus to a Bank of America branch where they pitched tents. They held signs and chanted, "Make banks pay." Police escorted the protesters out of the bank. Some demonstrators sat in the busy intersection of Wilshire and Westwood, shutting down traffic in all directions. Police arrested 11 people. On the UC Berkeley campus, thousands of students and supporters rallied, marched to a Bank of America branch, and then returned to the campus where they tried to set up an encampment twice. Police beat students and tore their tents down both times as students chanted, "Peaceful protest."
Peaceful protest! Peaceful protest! Peaceful protest!
Please take down the tents. Do not interfere with the actions of the police.
Officers from the UC Police were joined by the Oakland Police Department and Alameda County Sheriffs. They arrested six students and one professor. Brian Edwards Tiekert filed this report from the protest earlier in the day.
We will not pay for their crisis!
The crowd was densely packed in UC Berkeley's Sproul Plaza. One speaker after another testified to how they're being squeezed by rising student fees and shrinking public services. They point the finger squarely at the same targets as Occupy Wall Street protests. Large financial firms they accuse of wrecking the economy and siphoning money out of public coffers through bailouts and tax breaks.
My name is Margaret. My mom is a UC employee. I'm a UC student. Our family's suffering heavily from all the budget cuts. The bulk of our costs are funded by our tuition. This is supposed to be public education, and it's not anymore. It's private.
My name's Alex, and we're out here because we think we're getting screwed. And, you know, we're students. We're about to graduate with $1 trillion of debt, which is going to make it impossible to be real citizens in this country.
Ramon Quintero.
Why are you out here?
I'm here to protest the bailout of the banks at the cost of the working people of the United States.
I am ready to stay the night. Yeah, we have plans in place to have a wonderful group dinner and talk about tuition hikes and who's being forced out and which communities are being disproportionately affected.
The Occupy Cal protest is partly a warm-up for protests set to take place at next Wednesday's meeting of the UC Regents in San Francisco. Student groups and unions are planning to bus hundreds to the meeting, where they'll demand that regents with ties to large financial firms endorse taxing the wealthy, reforming California's Proposition 13, and rolling back fee hikes and service cuts. Brian Edwards Tiekert, Pacifica Radio KPFA, at Occupied UC Berkeley.
There's been a 10% jump in the number of homes entering foreclosure in October over the previous month. The number of homes scheduled to be auctioned or repossessed by lenders also posted monthly increases. Combined, notices of default, scheduled auctions, and bank repossessions hit a 7-month high last month. A former European Central Bank vice president has been chosen to head Greece's new crisis coalition government. Loukas Papademos said the Greek economy is facing huge problems, but remaining in the eurozone is necessary.
Participation in the eurozone will bring financial stability. It is a factor in financial welfare of the country.
Papademos' remarks were translated. Papademos and his crisis government will try to save the country from default and bankruptcy. Severe austerity measures will be the price. Republican presidential candidate and Texas Governor Rick Perry says he stepped in it during last night's Republican presidential debate when he couldn't remember the third federal agency he said he would eliminate.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and the
EPA?
Oh, EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop deposition.
Seriously?
Perry later said it was the Energy Department. Last night's stumble came after a Perry speech that provided ample material for late-night comedians, in which Perry was sometimes incoherent, rambled, and ended up hugging a bottle of maple syrup. At last night's debate, Herman Cain was briefly asked about the growing number of sexual harassment allegations against him. The crowd booed the question, and Cain called the allegations unfounded. Police in riot gear sprayed pepper spray as some 2,000 students at Penn State flooded downtown after longtime football coach Joe Paterno was fired. Trustees fired Paterno and the university president amid a growing furor linked to their handling of sex abuse allegations against a former assistant football coach. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on KPFK.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and now for our daily roundup of the Occupy movement. Occupy Together is reporting there are now occupations in 2,392 cities, 20,485 occupiers. By looking at the map, it looks like about 30 countries right now. Also, you heard in the news headlines the update of what happened yesterday at UC Berkeley. The blog on Common Dreams is reporting that a number of students, 39 protesters, they reported, were arrested thus far, and they were being held at the Glenn E. Dreyer Detention Facility in Oakland. Occupy Cal participants voted to strike. Like, this was about 1:30 or so in the morning. The vote passed by a count of 569 yes, 31 no's, and 29 abstentions. So activity picking up on university campuses. Is going to be a strike next week. Also, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Occupy Harvard is underway, and they have claimed Harvard Yard outside the John, right under the John Harvard statue. Occupy Cambridge rallied in support of Occupy Harvard. Apparently, the student life dean came and spoke to about 100 students and expressed support for them, but asked them to occupy somewhere else. But instead, the occupiers started putting up tents while the divinity students created a ring of protection around them. And it is reported there are about 20 tents now in Harvard Yard. Also, Occupy Wall Street apparently got their generators back after their lawyers noted there was no legal reason for having taken them in the first place. And here in Southern California, a new development, there is a movement called Occupy Pasadena's Rose Parade, where Occupy groups are targeting the Rose Parade. There's also Occupy Pasadena, which apparently is different from Occupy the Rose Parade, and the two groups are having some discussion about how they could come together. And out in California's Imperial Valley, there is an Occupy El Centro and Occupy Imperial Valley. And one of the chants they have is Toma el Valle, or Take the Valley. So quite a lot of Occupy activities happening in Northern California in Bayview, inspired by the Occupy movement. Over 100 people showed up late last week outside the homes of two African-American families in Bayview who were in danger of having their homes taken. So quite a lot happening. And on the line with us to give us an update from Occupy Wall Street, and also to give us her assessment about what the Occupy movement has won thus far, I'd like to welcome back Jackie DeSalvo, who is an activist with Occupy Wall Street and a member of the Labor Outreach Working Group. Jackie DeSalvo, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Margaret.
Jackie, you're going to tell us some. There's so much going on in Occupy Wall Street. We likely won't be able to hear all of it with the time that we have, but give us your assessment on the impact the Occupy movement has had thus far. from your perspective?
Well, I guess first the most obvious thing, it's the first national mass movement that includes all the issues. So it is much broader and more powerful than the movements of the 60s. I think the main effect it has had is it has altered the political landscape in this country because it has revealed that the media and the politicians have lied to us over the last years, implying that groups like the right-wing Republicans and the Tea Party and the right-wing Christians represent the attitudes of the American people. Occupy Wall Street, with the enormous support it's getting, in New York, 60% of the people support it, as opposed to only 20-something percent supporting the Tea Party. It shows that the real politics of the people are a fairly class-conscious opposition to the 1%, to the ruling class in this country, a very radical position to the left of the Democratic Party. So I think that has completely changed the landscape, and we saw that in Ohio. The vote in Ohio is historic. The ability to overturn an anti-labor law that would have denied workers collective bargaining by 68% to 32%, when we have been told that the taxpayers and the population in general are hostile to trade unions, and especially to public sector unions, who were the ones who were attacked in Ohio. We saw people come out in support of those public sector unions. So the new kind of unity that's being created between public and private sector, between middle class and working class, across ethnic lines, this is, and linking issues together, this is an incredibly hugely forward for American politics. The other thing I would mention is the transformation of labor. Our labor outreach committee in a short period of time has changed the New York labor movement. The labor movement is now supporting something far militant, more militant than anything they have ever supported before. And in some cases, they are welcoming us to bring that militancy to their unions. Last night, there was a demonstration at Sotheby's, the elite auction house, which has locked out its workers. Hundreds of people were there from at least a dozen different unions. Occupy Wall Street people got arrested, blocking the entrance to the auction for the second time. And this was cheered by the workers, both those on who are locked out and those supporting them. The other thing that's happening, and there's other forms of militancy that are new. The phone workers are marching from Albany to Zuccotti Park, stopping at the occupations along the way. This is a much more militant step than they have taken before.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's really significant is that we have been facilitating the solidarity between unions. We haven't had a labor movement. We've had labor unions. They fight for the interests, narrow contract interest of their own workers, not even for broader interests in legislation that affect them. But the Occupy Wall Street links these things. And at our meeting 2 weeks ago, there happened to be two Teamster locals. One, a group of African-American workers who are being discriminated against for their race and because they are strong union supporters at Woodlawn Cemetery, and the other, the Teamster local at Sotheby's. They met each other at our meeting, and they were on the picket line together last night, and the Sotheby's workers will be going to a rally at Woodlawn. This is a new kind of solidarity with all those unions turning out. We had to organize it. The labor movement did not organize it. The labor movement is going to be pushed to be functioning at a higher level of solidarity. And yesterday in the New York Times, they admitted as much. There is a very interesting article in the Times of the labor movement, the effect on the labor movement of Occupy Wall Street. And there are quotes from union members like Stuart Applebaum of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union saying, the Occupy movement has changed unions. You're going to see a lot more unions being wanting to be aggressive in their messaging and their activity. You're going to see more unions on the street wanting to tap into the energy of Occupy Wall Street. So this is a real shift, and it's going to change this country.
Yeah, and Jackie, just unbelievable. Also, we saw unions, a lot of unions coming out in support of the general strike that happened in Oakland. And this poll that says more than 6 in 10 Americans see the widening gap. That was a Washington Post ABC news poll. 61% say the gap is wider than in the past. 37% say much larger. And 84% of the much larger think that Washington should close the gap. And 75% of those making less than $20,000 a year support government action. So we're really seeing a shift happening in the debate in this country, a shift in public opinion than before Occupy Wall Street movement, where everything, the discussion back then seemed to be focused on cuts, on, you know, deficit reduction, on austerity. Jackie.
Yes. We're even winning specific victories without having raised demands about them. We did campaigns against the banks 2 weeks ago, and I think that directly affected Bank of America and the other banks rescinding the idea of having charges on debit cards.
Absolutely.
That was the first kind of immediate reform. I think we're going to see a lot of reforms as they try to give certain concessions for fear that the movement gets stronger and its goals get even larger goals become possible. So I think we're going to see all kinds of things. I think that it may change the ability of the super committee to enact the kind of program they were inclined towards. It's influencing Obama on the tar sands issue, the fact that people in the environmental movement were able to be much more militant in the context of the occupation movement. And right now there's a march from Zuccotti Park to Washington, which is going to stop at all the occupations along the way, that is pressing for ending the Bush tax cuts.
Right. Well, Jackie, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there, but we'll have you back. We hope that you could join us tomorrow morning, if that's at all possible. We'll be having our weekly roundtable. It's back after a few weeks' break because of our fund drive. And, of course, we'll be discussing all things Occupy. Jackie DeSalvo, thank you for joining us.
I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
All righty. Very good. We are going to take a very short break. And coming up, part three of our discussion with Erica Huggins, one of the few women Black Panther Party leaders, and later in our show, Ozo Motley at Occupy LA. We'll be right back.
Hell now, brown, down with the Mau Mau clown, downtown, trying to put us in a dog pound like a trap ground with the situation.
Well, you know, calluses come,
so it's written dialectical analysis. So how is this? We never had no funk until you found out that our trunks are revolutionary, huh?
Chuck,
bump you over like dominoes, rat.
So free Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Lyric, lyric, can't get near it. Got a sample, didn't clear it. Point blank says 5-0, that's the spirit. Cheer it. Spat out the fact that I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American.
They go to like a Cherokee.
Disparaging.
But that ain't nothing new.
Told the streets where they would go, whoever paved that.
Got minimum wage, too.
Yeah, and that music was from The Coup and Dig It. And we are now going to, I'm told that Melissa Figueroa is on the line with us before we go to the Erica Huggins interview. Melissa was part of the protest that happened at UC yesterday. Melissa, we're a little behind in our time, but I wanted to just check in with you. We heard that there were arrests that happened. Give us a quick assessment of the situation at UC Berkeley.
Hi, thanks, Margaret. What I saw during the protest yesterday was pretty shocking. The tents came up at the encampment after the students voted 456-1 to set up the encampment, knowing that the administration was not going to allow tents to be put up. So in the afternoon, there were about 2 tents put up and about maybe several hundred students forming a human chain around the tents. The UCPD came and we were, sort of chanting back and forth, saying, "This is a peaceful protest. This is free speech." It was pretty iconic because the very place we were on was the Mario Savio steps, the birthplace of the free speech movement.
Mm.
And as we were sitting there, there's a pretty shocking video on YouTube that shows part of what happened, that the cops came in totally unprovoked, other than students saying that we are here to exercise our free speech rights, and started beating students.
Oh, my.
One English PhD student was taken to the ER because of injuries that he sustained at the hands of the cops. The same thing happened later in the night around 9:30. We had actually the cops had been called off Sproul Plaza, and we had control of Sproul Plaza for the afternoon and the evening until about 9:30. Students formed a human chain again around the now probably 6 or 7 tents that had gone up. And it was a very, very traumatizing sight for a lot of students that were there. The police came in again, batons swinging. Several of my friends were hit. I was hit once as well. Students were being pulled out of the line. I saw one student being pulled out and beaten quite severely by about 4 or 5 cops. The whole crowd was remaining peaceful. The whole crowd was trying to appeal to the police, even appeal to the police's humanity by chanting, "You are the 99%. Why are you carrying out the orders of the regents and the banks?" Again, the level of brutality deployed on students last night shocked and dismayed, everyone who was there. And by the time I left, which was about maybe 1:30 in the morning, I actually left before the strike vote was taken, but there was about 1,500 to 2,000 students still on the Mario Savio steps.
Just amazing. Melissa, you were hit. Are you all right? Of course,
yeah,
we worry
fine.
About
I,
you.
Yeah, no, I'm fine. Yeah. I was trying to, see what was, I was trying to defend my friends and see what was going on. And, because it was very chaotic the way that the police came in the line. So, it was a glancing
alarm. Right. Well, I'm glad you were able to get in. I know it was a very late night for you to get up to give us this urgent report. I haven't really seen coverage on mainstream media about what happened at UC Berkeley last night. And from what you're saying, it really is quite serious. So, Melissa, we are going to check back in with you later on in the day, if we may, and just to see how everything is. And of course, there's another action planned for next week. Is that right, by the students?
Yes. So, late last night, the students voted to call for a strike, a student strike, on next Tuesday, November 15th.
Okay.
This is in advance of our other planned actions on Wednesday, November 16th at the Regents meeting in San Francisco.
Right. So the 15th and 16th, 2 days of action. And just very quickly wrapping it up, Melissa, is there a connection with the student protests? I know these are mainly student actions, but is there support coming from Occupy Oakland?
Oh, absolutely. Late last night, after the second police attack, several big contingent from Occupy Oakland as well as Occupy San Francisco came, maybe about 100 people or so, to support the students. Again, because there's a very, very strong recognition that our struggles are linked together, the struggle of the students and the struggle of Occupy Wall Street, as well as, people who are actively organizing in both in Occupy Oakland and Berkeley, and as well as SF and Berkeley, that there's a very strong sense of solidarity across communities and across the Bay as well. The Bay Area is a hotbed right now, I have to say.
Have you seen anything like this, Melissa, this kind of mobilization that's happening now with the occupations and student strikes?
I am continually surprised with the level of numbers that turn out, you know, almost spontaneously, but also the level of very, very dedicated organizing on the part of a fairly large number of students. I've been involved in the organizing for the action yesterday as well as the actions of next week. And the response, again, is amazing. I don't think I have seen that kind of responsiveness and quick mobilization and the ability to mobilize, like, you know, incredibly quickly. It's pretty surprising, and, I mean, you know, pleasantly, of course.
Right. Well, Melissa Figueroa, former assistant producer here at Sojourner Truth and now a graduate student at UC Berkeley, you stay safe and continue to keep us posted on what's happening. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. So much action happening there. And we're going to look backwards in order to look forward as well. We're now going to go to part three of the conversation we had with Erica Huggins. She is now a human rights activist, poet, professor of women's studies and sociology at San Francisco State University and Cal State University East Bay. She was a Black Panther Party leader in Los Angeles for 14 years, the youngest of any woman in leadership. And then after her husband, John Huggins, was killed along with Alprentice Bunchy Carter on the campus at the UCLA, at UCLA in 1969, Erica moved to the East Coast, formed a Black Panther Party in New Haven, Connecticut. And then she and fellow party leader Bobby Seale, as part of the FBI's COINTELPRO program, were arrested, and Erica spent 2 years, much of which in solitary confinement. We spoke with Erica Huggins recently, and yesterday we heard her talking about what happened at the UCLA campus in some detail and about how she was arrested right after her husband was shot dead at the UCLA campus, and about her time in a prison and the women who come comforted her there. We're now going to continue that discussion where she talks about her time in New Haven, Connecticut, and another stage of her life. After all of that experience, and you took your husband's body home, you have a baby, but yet you didn't stop your activism. You know, tell us about this next stage.
Well,
of what happened.
A group of Yale students and a group of progressive people in the African-American community in New Haven, which is quite a Black community, by the way. People misunderstand because Yale is there,
yeah,
that with all of its privilege, that's what New Haven is. But New Haven has its poorer communities have the demographics of Oakland or South Central Los Angeles or Hunters Point Bayview in San Francisco, or
yeah, Bedford-Stuyvesant,
Harlem,
Brooklyn,
Bedford-Stuyvesant, New Bedford. I mean, all of the places are alike.
Yeah.
And they asked that the students and the community members asked that I stay and start a chapter of the party, and so I decided to do so. And then within 3 months, again, FBI COINTELPRO sets up a situation where Bobby Seale and myself and 12 other people were arrested for conspiracy with the intent to commit murder.
Mm. Yes, and that was the case of Alex Rackley, was it?
That's correct. He was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
I did not murder him.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby Seale did not murder him.
Yeah.
But he was murdered by a man posing as a party member. He was working for the government and for the FBI.
Yeah. And I actually remember that campaign, a few of the campaigns, the Free Angela campaign and also the Free Erica, Free Bobby campaign. So tell us about that. How long Were you in prison, and what kind of treatment was afforded you there?
I was in prison for 2 years, 14 months awaiting trial and 6 months on trial. 3 months of that was absorbed in choosing a jury because there was so much bias.
Yeah.
And I had some of the best progressive lawyers in the country, Charlie Gary and Katie Rohrabach. And my life literally was saved by them, I believe,
yeah.
Because the climate of the country at the time was so biased and so violent, not to mention, you know, the behind-the-scenes activities of the FBI.
This was the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s.
I was arrested in May 1969.
Yeah.
And I was released from prison in May of 1971.
Yeah. Yes.
So my treatment, I was isolated with three other members of the Black Panther Party. We were isolated in one small corridor in Niantic Women's Prison outside of New Haven, Connecticut, about an hour away from New Haven, and we were transported to court together. And then all of them were released. And because those were not the people they wanted to they wanted Bobby and myself.
Yeah.
And so then I was put in solitary confinement. And Angela Davis was in solitary confinement in the Women's House of Detention in New York City just before that, and her lawyers had gotten her out of solitary because it was cruel and unusual punishment.
And tell us about that. How was it? You know, what did solitary confinement mean in terms of what happened to you?
In New Haven, it was a locked room with a barred window. It wasn't like it wasn't the stereotypical image of, let's say, what we call the hole.
Okay.
But I could not leave. I don't care how, you know, well equipped the room was. I didn't have keys. I could not talk to any other human beings. I could not exchange information with any of the prisoners.
Mm.
I could only talk to my lawyers. I could only see my daughter, who was 3 months old at the time, for 1 hour once a week.
Mm.
And so it was there, you know, both in, after the women were gone and I was in that isolated corridor, I was there before they put me by myself in this huge corridor for a few months, and then I was put in solitary confinement. In both those situations of isolation, I realized that it was important for me to take care of my mind and my body, so I began to practice hatha yoga, physical yoga,
mm-hmm.
Which has now become a fad for many.
Yeah.
And I also taught myself to meditate, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that sitting still and noticing my breath would be so helpful. And so I did, and I would do this every day before I went to trial. And I was transported in a caravan, by the way, me in a highway patrol car with three or four cars in front of it and three or four cars behind it.
Mm.
Because when I asked why, they said, because someone may come from the side of the road and break you out, which was hysterically funny to me that
all of this
was happening for one woman. And Bobby was transported in the same way. And Bobby was isolated in a similar way. At any rate, because Angela was released from solitary confinement in the Women's House of D, then I was released when my lawyers brought it to federal court in Connecticut, state court in Connecticut. The I was released from solitary confinement and put in to the mainstream population.
We are going to return to that conversation with Erica Huggins. We're going to take a very short station break. When we return, we'll continue with Erica Huggins. Also, we will hear the Ozo Motley at Occupy LA and our weekly Earth segment. We'll be right back.
It's almost time for the 10th annual Pacifica Radio Archives National Fund Drive broadcast. It's year 3 of the campus campaign, so every time you donate to us, we'll send a copy of an historic recording to a school or college of your choice.
It's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Coming Tuesday and Wednesday, November 15 and 16 on all 5 Pacifica stations. Help the archives take history out of the vault and into the classroom.
This is John Savage, and you're listening to the Fearless Drive Time Radio, Sojourner Truth, with host Margaret Prescott on Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
Let me tell you a little something about L.A.
I love it!
Now what you know about my city, that's tic-tac. Hustle to get stacks, fail, get laughed at. Even from here, I hear the chit-chat. Grew up, Miracle Mile, Fairfax, the tall traps, Hamilton High, alumni.
And the City of Angels by Ozo Motley. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Ulysses Bella of Ozo Motley on Occupy LA. We're now, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are going to return now to our conversation with Erica Huggins, lead one of the few women leaders of the Black Panther Party. How much do you think? I mean, there was a massive movement at the time, Free Angela, of course, but also on May 1970, about approximately 15,000 Black Panther Party members and supporters came to New Haven to protest the trial. And I do remember a lot of talk around the movement at the time and a lot of support out there. And I'm wondering what you think the impact. I know you said you had very good lawyers and you credit them with saving your life. But what role did the movement play, you think, in the fact
well,
that you were freed?
It. Yes, and let me clarify. My lawyers were part of that movement.
Right.
They couldn't divulge the inner workings of the trial, but they were part of that. Kingman Brewster, who was the president of Yale, spoke out on our behalf and got a lot of flack for doing so. 15,000 people certainly wasn't all party members.
Yeah, and supporters.
There were hundreds of party members that showed up. But these are supporters all over the country, and people came in from around the world to support us. So it was a part of the people's movement. We were all about coalition at the time. So there were people representing all kinds of organizations who had come to support myself and Bobby and others who were on trial. So I owe my life to so many people and to all of those people who gathered for those rallies. That had a profound impact because, again, as I said before, mainstream America was thinking of us as a gang.
Yeah.
And that showed the world that we were stepping forward to provide for the communities what the government had not. All of the mass media projections of guns and uniforms and berets and all of that masculine bravado was something that gets held in the American psyche as the Black Panther Party. But we had over 20 community programs, some of them still in existence around the country, like our free clinics. and our school programs, our after-school programs particularly, and liberation school programs, there are all kinds of community models that people took on in New Haven, as well as other places around the country.
Absolutely.
And the breakfast program, the Breakfast for Children program, so embarrassed the federal government that it created the National Free Breakfast and Lunch Program.
Right, and the FBI, Hoover, I think, said the free breakfast program of the Black Panther Party was one of the most dangerous, subversive, you know,
yes,
programs in the country.
Yes, he did. He said that exactly.
Yeah.
So,
Eric, I also wanted to ask you this as well. This issue you mentioned before about the infiltration that happened, and you gave a pretty, you thought maybe one out of every 3 to 4 people perhaps in the organizations were agents. The situation in Chicago with the Black Panther Party, the head of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, being killed. It was his wife was in the bed at the time he was shot. She was pregnant at the time. The person who set up that operation was the chief of security, from what I understood, of Fred Hampton. So, you know, there's so much infiltration that happened back then. And there's infiltration that continues. We see a movement coming up now. I wanted to get your reaction to that a little bit with the Occupy movements that are spreading around the place. And there always is the question of, is there anything that an organization can do, that a network, an activist can do to sort of guard themselves against that kind of infiltration? Or do you know what I mean? Is there any particular thing people should watch out for? Or
they could just be aware of people who are particularly incendiary, who want to do crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
Who want to create violence where there wasn't any before, or create conflict where there wasn't any before. In all of the instances that I've described to you today and others that I have not mentioned, this is what occurred, you know?
Yeah.
This is what occurred. And I would also say it's important to form coalition across race, class, gender, and sexual orientation and citizenship status lines. It's important to do that.
I also wanted to ask you about the issue of sexism and within the organization and within the party, because early on, before you joined the Black Panther Party, you had your own struggles of facing sexism. And certainly the statement that Stokely Carmichael made, he became the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, of the role of women in the revolution was to be prone. I do remember that, and it caused quite a lot of controversy. And I wondered how the women within the organization dealt with the sexism in the organization.
Well, I think it's unfortunate also that we hold Stokely Carmichael to one statement he made when he did so much that was great. I certainly don't want to be held accountable for one statement I made 40 years ago.
Sure.
And few people understand that he did apologize for it. And he woke up also. His consciousness was raised as a result of that. This is how we learn through our mistakes.
Right. I'm raising it just at the time it was really a reflection of a very heated discussion that I recall. Yeah.
Look at our music today.
Yeah.
Look at the huge numbers of misuses and abuses to women today, even more now that we are so technologically savvy. So nothing much has changed, I'm sorry to say, in that way. We have to change it. And what women in the Black Panther Party did was when we saw something that was sexist or even misogynist within the Black Panther Party, by that I mean violence toward women, violent physical actions and violent words and violent statements or violent decision-making all go hand in hand. But we often think little of words and decision making. We put them in another category. So I'm bringing them all to the fore. Yeah. Whenever we saw something like that, we would speak about it, or we'd write a memo to the party central committee about it. As a matter of fact, toward the last few years of the Black Panther Party, a group of women wrote a memo about there not being women in the party's leadership, the leadership body, the central committee. So we spoke up about what we saw to the best of our ability.
Yeah.
And changes occurred because we talked about it out loud. And if people are interested in reading more about, how Huey Newton, for instance, felt about this, they can read in the Huey P. Newton Reader, which is a collection of his essays. He wrote a memo in support of the women's liberation movement and the gay liberation movement. And that article, that essay in that book, which was first something he brought to party members and then became an article in the Village Voice, he wrote that in 1970.
Mm.
I don't know another black man who's come forward to write such a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm working my way now through To Die for the People by Huey P. Newton.
Well, the Huey P. Newton Reader is a collection of essays, and it's worth your read.
Okay.
And anybody listening. So we just work with it, and we weren't always able to change everything, but we were able to, but we spoke up about it, and that's half of it. And we took care of one another. We spoke up on behalf of one another. And we did the same thing. We spoke up on behalf of the children. That was actually how we started the Oakland Community School, because we thought that an after-school program or a tutoring program wasn't enough. And the Oakland Community School lasted for 10 years as a result and educated so many children and so many families in that period of time in the Bay Area.
We thank you for your time, Erica Huggins, and we hope that you'll be able to join us again.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
And that was part three of our conversation with Erica Huggins, one of the few women leaders of the Black Panther Party. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to go to an interview that I did with Ulysses Bella at Occupy LA about Occupy LA. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio. And who am I with?
You're with Ulysses Bella from Ozomatli.
All righty. And tell us why you came down here and shared some beats with us today at Occupy LA.
Well, I think for a while we've been wanting to play Occupy LA. We spent some time here and we talked to some of the organizers, and we felt that we had to pick a certain day and a certain time to really make an impact about it. So today worked out for us, and showed up, asked some extra help over here, the horns wise, and it ended up going off, you know.
Right. What do you think the significance of this movement is? I mean, it's growing, it's spreading around the world. What is your hope right now? What do you think?
Well, my hope, I think it's a global epiphany of sorts, I feel. It's a global awakening of how divided things are. And this isn't just a situation here in the United States, obviously. It's something that, you know, us being traveling around the world, you see how it goes down in other places around the world and how the divisions that we sometimes consider, you know, as far as human beings, sometimes are very illusionary to the things we have in common, you know? And obviously, healthcare, education, services, social services, things that the people need are very important all around the world for everybody. So I think in a lot of ways this is the beginning moments of a global epiphany of that, yes, that there are resources that need to be shared, and there's certain things that no matter how, that are so important, they shouldn't be about profit.
Yeah, finally, what do you think this movement will have an impact in the many problems that are being faced in black and brown communities? We've got ICE raids, we've got people, mothers being separated from their families, you've got unemployment among young black men at around 40%, 1 in 3 if trends continue will end up in prison. What do you think? Is this movement a place for all of those issues?
Yes, I do think it's a place for all those issues. And I do hope that in a lot of ways this movement helps, because obviously, particularly in Los Angeles, there has been that divide sometimes between black and brown communities, and there has been violence in school between these communities. And for me, it's completely heartbreaking. It really kills my morale and my whole spirit to see that here we are, people of obviously different roots, but yet we're all in the same boat together. And anything that creates that kind of unity between those communities, obviously, I'm all...
Yeah, and he just said he was all for it, creating unity. And that was Ulysses Bea of Ozo Motley. I caught up with him at Occupy LA. We're now going to wrap up our show with our weekly Earth segment back after the break of Fund Drive. And I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Ellen Choi. She is of Chinese and Korean ancestry, and she is an organizer with the Mobilization for Climate Justice West, a grassroots coalition of Bay Area groups fighting for climate justice locally through direct action and movement building. Ellen, thank you so very much for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Margaret.
Yeah. Now, Ellen, we're having this discussion within the context of this really scary storm that happened up in Alaska. The effects are still being felt. The super storm that came out of the Bering Sea and slammed coastal Alaska yesterday. It was a Category 4, very, very rare for that, you know, that level of storm. And also there was a storm, I understand, in the Mediterranean, a storm named Rolf, which was a rare hybrid extratropical storm. Usually the waters of the Mediterranean are too cold for this kind of storm development. So what do you think? Are we seeing, do you think this stuff is related to climate change?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think because of just the consistency and amount and magnitude of all of the storms and natural disasters that are happening at one time, scientists around the world have already connected it to man-made pollution. So I think it's really clear that this is a moment where folks are realizing, okay, the things that we've actually done to the Earth are now... the Mother Earth is really showing her repercussions on our communities. So, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, and also you have, you know, bringing this to the local work that you're doing, you have been part of Occupy Oakland, and I'm wondering if you could say something about how the issues of climate change and climate justice coming up in the Occupy movement. And we already see an impact, because actually on the proposed Keystone Pipeline, the Obama administration is now talking about needing a bit more time to reassess the proposed route. Ellen,
that's right.
Choi.
Yeah, so I've been organizing around climate change for a few years, and I also, since Occupy Oakland, I've been resident of Oakland, sprung up. I've been supporting more peripherally, but I was organizing around the general strike last year. And so it's interesting because we haven't seen the environmental movement or ecological issues been forefront inside of the Occupy movement, but there's a really clear connection. I mostly organize with low-income communities of color, and fighting for the right to breathe clean air or drink clean water, those things have been at the front lines of the 99% versus the 1% battle. So communities like Richmond, California up here, who's fighting a Chevron refinery in the Bay Area, or even Wilmington in L.A., who's up against 4 different oil refineries in their communities, they know very well what income disparity feels like, those communities, and they've been fighting for their lives on this front line for many, many years. So it'll be interesting, really, to see how folks who are organizing around environmental justice and climate change and, for example, how the fight against the Keystone Pipeline, where indigenous communities have been at the forefront for a while, how those folks are going to be tying in the Occupy framework and be able to connect to the 99% movement. Yeah, I'm really excited to see how that happens. And in December, there's a UN climate negotiations, which happens every year. This year, it's in Durban, South Africa. And we have communities also calling for an International Day of Action on December 3rd called the Thousand Durbans in solidarity with what's going on in South Africa. And so I know that there's a lot of communities, especially here in the U.S., who are also looking to make that connection. I know here in the Bay, we're thinking about doing some things directly in connection with Occupy Oakland.
Right. And of course, here on Sojourner Truth, we'll be carrying daily coverage Tuesday to Fridays throughout that Durban conference. We're partnering with the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them each week for our Earth Minute as well as our Earth segment. So we very much look forward to that. And, you know, I imagine, Ellen, as you're saying in Oakland, that you'll be connecting the December 3rd International Day of Action with the occupation movement happening there, and likely that is bound to happen in other places as well. In New York, Occupy New York, they're now started a march yesterday to Washington, D.C. Ellen, some final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I'm just excited to see what happens on December 3rd. I know here in the Bay Area, we're looking to do an action around reclaiming our resources and reclaiming our land here in Oakland, which has been also central to the Occupy movement. And I think that's also one way where we can fight for real solutions from the grassroots on issues like climate change. So it will be exciting.
Right. Ellen Choi, thank you for joining us. Ellen is also an active member with HOBAK, Hella Organized Bay Area Koreans, and is also a passionate community DJ. So that's great. Yeah. With our sister station at KPFA.
That's right.
All righty.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ellen Choi, thank you so very much for joining us. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our engineer, and the Sojourner Truth team, Teresa McGee, Eric Doyle, assistant producer Sarah Shakur. Also, we'd like to thank Sammy Mangello for his help. You can follow us on Twitter at So True Radio. Become our Facebook friend. Look for Sojourner Truth Radio. And we'd like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project as well. If you would like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. I'd love to hear from you. I would really need your help here volunteering to help out the show. You could email me at mpkpfk@gmail.com. That's mpkpfk@gmail.com. Stay tuned for Uprising. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow morning. Our roundtable, our weekly roundtable, will be back. You don't want to miss that. Thank you so very much for listening. And this is your host, Margaret Prescott.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I'm waiting.
Turn it over like push, did a boatload of hate.